P-minus 97. Landing site, Solar City Sanctuary. The skyline of Sanctuary, or rather the distinct and equally incredible skylines that met Dan's eyes as he gazed from the pyramids on one side of the Titanic statue to the towers on the other, were utterly miraculous. When it crossed his mind that this might be just one small part of a richly colonized planet, he struggled to even imagine what else might lie in wait. He had never intended to be away from home for long, and knew that a prolonged absence from both Earth and New Kerguelen could greatly exacerbate the fear-driven problems that his leap of destiny across the latter's mysterious skygate had been intended to allay. Despite this keenness to leave sooner rather than later, though, and purely because his group's trip to meet the Small's so-called principal was clearly not optional, Dan consciously decided to try to make the best of the situation and allow his mind to focus on the discoveries and revelations sure to lie around each corner. Unlike his first sightings of New Kerguelen, within that planet's extensive and ironically unnecessary great shelter, Dan's initial subconscious reaction to Sanctuary itself, as the fear for his group's safety continued to fade, was a feeling of something not a million miles from satisfaction. The surroundings Dan encountered during his pioneering trip to New Kerguelen, which, like this one, had been conducted for an important purpose, rather than as any kind of elective adventure, proved disappointing to the sci-fi-loving child within him who had dreamed of futuristic cities and enormous monuments since reading about countless imagined worlds during long summers in Birchwood. Already, this first city of Sanctuary, Solar City, as he would soon come to know it, was more visually striking than any Dan had ever seen on a television or cinema screen, and even his unbound childhood mind had never dreamed up anything quite like this. All it was missing was a few flying cars and perhaps some cyberpunk-infused billboards, he thought with his first smile since arriving, and the picture would have been complete. The air itself, meanwhile, was hot and thick, more Barbados than Birchwood, but Sanctuary's sun felt comfortable and pleasant on Dan's skin, although he knew far better than to look at it directly or even peripherally enough to judge its scale within the familiarly blue sky, its hue was more orange than yellow. The blueness of the sky in itself told Dan one thing, which came as little surprise. Like Earth and New Kerguelen, Sanctuary was a world covered largely by water. It would have been easy for things like this to bring up questions in Dan's mind as to how so many such coincidences could be possible, and how it was that both of the other intelligent races he had directly encountered just so happened to breathe the same kind of air and thrive on worlds with effectively identical levels of gravity, pressure, and everything else needed to comfortably sustain their respective biologies. But in reality, of course, none of these things just so happened to be the case. In reality, the three similar but different humanoid races who currently had individuals walking on Sanctuary had all been brought together by a fourth, the Architects. With all the evidence pointing towards the Architects being a race as close to omnipotent as any could ever hope to be, it no longer struck Dan as unbelievable that they had been able to cast an incomprehensibly wide net in searching the universe for intelligent humanoid races such as his own. Whether the Architects had encountered dozens, hundreds, thousands, or just these three was something Dan couldn't possibly know. But it was the Architect's influence in all of this that took things out of the realm of coincidence. They had consciously brought together these three similar races, whether choosing them from a vast pool of varyingly different races, or whether these had been the only three discovered. If no other intelligent races beyond humanity, the messengers in the Smalls had been discovered, Dan pondered. That fact added weight to the old rare earth hypothesis he himself had wrestled with in the past when considering the likelihood of other races ever coming into contact with humanity. The presence of a broad range of seemingly improbable conditions were responsible for Earth's suitability as a home ground for truly intelligent life to develop and evolve, with emphasis often placed on the importance of variables ranging from the presence of a magnetic field, plate tectonics, a stable orbit around a stable star, and even a surrounding planetary arrangement, such as Earth's solar system, which would be capable of reducing the likelihood of the intelligence's host planet being struck by extinction-level impact events before the race reached a point in evolution at which they would be able to protect themselves. Even humanity hadn't quite been there when Il Diavolo's collision course with Earth was first detected, Dan considered, and only the architect's ultimate intervention at the behest of the messengers had saved the day. New Kerguelen evidently met the requirements for complex bipedal life to evolve, and to this end, it should perhaps have come as little surprise that its atmospheric composition and geological makeup shared so much with Earth's. And although Sanctuary had only just been discovered and had been analyzed by nothing more than the awestruck eyes of its visitors, it seemed to go without saying that it too was a Goldilocks planet on which all the necessary prerequisites for intelligent life, each cosmically uncommon in its own right and thus all remarkably improbable to be present in the same place at the same time, came together to make Dan McCarthy feel like he was on a tropical island a short plane ride away, rather than a truly foreign world accessible only via an incomprehensible portal. This portal, which traversed the unknown but presumably enormous distance between New Kerguelen and Sanctuary, was undoubtedly the piece of the puzzle Dan had least hope of ever understanding. He doubted that his or any other human brain could possibly understand the physics at play, even if an attempted explanation ever came their way. It might, he thought, be like a human trying to explain to a goldfish how a plane stays in the air. Under the orange sun and blue sky, this area of Sanctuary's ground had a slightly springy quality to it. The spacecraft's ramp extended to the edge of the marked landing circle, taking Dan's group onto a green area of something that looked almost like dense and very short grass, but didn't quite feel like it. The surface-covering plant was almost more like a tall moss than a short grass, and only when everyone was walking on it did Dan belatedly notice that his group was missing a member. Leisha. "I'm still here," the alien replied immediately, his words entering Dan's mind telepathically as they always did. Dan, like Tara and Billy, was wearing an uplift patch which enabled him to understand the thoughts Leisha sent through the air using his own innate ability to do so. Another one of the alien's abilities, that of visually cloaking himself, was evidently being exercised in tandem. Unsure whether the smalls would be picking up on Leisha's thoughts, or indeed his own, Dan gulped and held his breath for several seconds. In cloaking himself to avoid their detection, Leisha's action could be seen as a method of deceiving his hosts, and one to which they might not take too kindly. No reaction came to Leisha's communication, however, telling Dan that the smalls weren't able to hear his thoughts. "I don't know if they can hear yours," Leisha continued, picking up on Dan's, as he always could, and answering a question that thus didn't have to be explicitly asked. "Do your best to project a question about the statue and see if they answer." Dan did as his alien friend suggested, focusing his full attention on telepathically sending a specific thought to the small's leader. No reply came, nor even any acknowledgement. "Ask out loud," Leisha suggested. The lack of reaction from either Tara or Billy, both walking tightly at Dan's right-hand side, indicated that the alien was utilizing his own telepathic acuity to address this suggestion only to Dan. Dan took a sharp breath, rather than a deep one, and blurted it out before giving himself a chance to overthink. "Can we see the front of that statue?" At once, every small stopped walking and turned to face him.
"No," the leader replied. "Questions will come and answers will follow. Our principal will be keen to meet you." "From high he guards," the pack added, right on cue.
They quickly followed their leader in resuming their journey towards the towers, herding the increasingly confused humans along with them.